Carlos Castaneda's The Second Ring of Power, Chapter 6, the last chapter, Part 1, The Second Attention. "You have to leave later on today," LaGuardia said to me right after breakfast. "Since you have decided to go with us, you have committed yourself to helping us fulfill our new task. The Narwhal left me in charge only until you came. He entrusted me, as you already know, with certain things to tell you. I've told you most of them, but there are still some I couldn't mention to you until you made your choice. Today we will take care of them. Right after that, you must leave in order to give us time to get ready. We need a few days to settle everything and to prepare to leave these mountains forever. We have been here for a very long time. It's hard to break away, but everything has to come to a sudden end. The Narwhal warned us that the total change that you would bring, regardless of the outcome of your bouts, but I think no one really believed him. I fail to see why you have to change anything," I said. "I've explained to you already," she protested. "We have lost our old purpose. Now we have a new one, and the new purpose requires that we become as light as the breeze. The breeze is our new mood. It used to be the hot wind. You have changed our direction." Wish I could change the page here. There we go. "You are talking in circles, Gorda." "Yes, that's because you're empty. I can't make it any clearer. When you return, the Generals will show you the art of the Stalker, and right after that, all of us will leave. The Narwhal said, if you decided to be with us, the first thing I should tell you is that you have to remember your bouts with Soldad and the Little Sisters and examine every single thing that happened to you with them, because everything is an omen of what will happen to you on your path. If you are careful and impeccable, you'll find that those bouts were gifts of power." "What's Donna Soledad going to do now?" "She's leaving. The Little Sisters have already helped her to take her floor apart. The floor aided her to reach her attention of the Narwhal. The lines had power to do that. Each of them helped her gather a piece of that attention. To be incomplete is no handicap to reaching that attention for some warriors. Soledad was transformed because she got that attention to that attention faster than any of us. She doesn't have to gaze at her floor anymore to go into the other world. And now that there is no more need for the floor, she has returned it to the earth where she got it." You're really determined to leave, Gorda, aren't you?" "All of us are. That's why I'm asking you to go away for a few days, to give us time to pull down everything we have. I am the one who has to find the place for all of you, Gorda. If you were an impeccable warrior, you would do just that. But you're not an impeccable warrior, and neither are we. But still, we have to do our best to meet our new challenge." I felt an oppressive sense of doom. I had never been one to thrive on responsibility. I thought that the commitment to guide them was a crushing burden that I could not handle. "Maybe we don't have to do anything," I said. "Yes, that's right," she said and laughed. "Why don't you tell yourself that over and over until you feel safe? The Narwhal told you time and time again that the only freedom warriors have is to behave impeccably. She told me how the Narwhal had insisted that all of them understand that not only is impeccability freedom, but it was the only way to scare away the human form. I narrated to her the way Don Juan made me understand what he meant by impeccability. He and I were hiking one day through a very steep ravine where a huge boulder got loose from its matrix on the rock wall and came down with a formidable force and landed on the floor of the canyon, 20 or 30 yards from where we were standing. The size of the boulder made its fall a very impressive event. Don Juan seized the opportunity to create a dramatic lesson. He said that the force that rules our destinies is outside of ourselves and has nothing to do with our acts or volition. Sometimes that force would make us stop walking on our way and bend over to tie our shoelaces, as I had just done. And by making us stop, that force makes us gain a precious moment. If we had kept on walking, that enormous boulder would have most certainly crushed us to death. Some other day, however, in another ravine, the same outside force would make us stop again to bend over and tie our shoelaces, while another boulder would get loose precisely above where we were standing. By making us stop, that force would have made us lose a precious moment. That time, if we had kept on walking, we would have saved ourselves. Don Juan said that in view of my total lack of control over the forces which decide our destiny, my only possible freedom in that ravine consisted in my tying my shoelaces impeccably. Bogota seemed to be moved by my account. For an instant, she held my face in her hands from across the table. Impeccability for me is to tell you at the right time what the Nawal told me to tell you, she said. But power has to be timed perfectly. What I have to reveal to you, or it won't have any effect at all. She paused in a dramatic fashion. Her delay was very studied, but terribly effective with me. What is it? I asked desperately. She did not answer. She took me by the arm and led me to the area just outside the front door. She made me sit on the hard-packed ground with my back against a thick pole about 1.5 feet high that looked like a tree stump which had been planted in the ground almost against the wall of the house. There was a row of 5 such poles planted about 2 feet apart. I had meant to ask Lagorda what their function was. My first impression had been that a former owner of the house had tied animals to them. My conjecture seemed incongruous, however, because the area just outside the front door was a kind of roofed porch. I told Lagorda my supposition as she sat down next to me, to my left, with her back against another pole. She laughed and said that the poles were indeed used for tying animals of sorts, but not by a former owner, and that she had nearly broken her back digging the holes for them. What do you use them for? I asked. Let's say that we tie ourselves to them, she replied. And this brings me to the next thing the Nawal asked me to tell you. He said that because you were empty, he had to gather your second attention, your attention of the Nawal, in a way different than ours. He gathered that attention through dreaming, and we gathered that attention through dreaming, and you did it with power plants. The Nawal said that his power plants gathered the menacing side of your second attention in one clump, and that's the shape that came out of your head. He said that that's what happens to sorcerers when they are given power plants. If they don't die, the power plants spin their second attention into that awful shape that comes out of their heads. Now we're coming to what he wanted to do. He said that you must change directions now and begin gathering your second attention in another way, more like us. You can't keep on the path of knowledge unless you balance your second attention. So far, that attention of yours has been riding on the Nawal's power, but now you are alone. That's what he wanted me to tell you. How do I balance my second attention? You have to do it dreaming the way we do it. Dreaming is the only way to gather the second attention without injuring it, without making it menacing and awesome. Your second attention is fixed on the awful side of the world. Ours is on the beauty of it. You have to change sides and come with us. That's what you chose last night when you decided to go with us. Could that shape come out of me at any time? No, the Nawal said it wouldn't come out again until you were as old as he is. Your Nawal has already come out as many times as was needed. The Nawal and Janeiro have seen to that. They used to tease it out of you. The Nawal told me that sometimes you were a hair away from dying because your second attention is very indulging. He said that once you even scared him, your Nawal attacked him and he had to sing to it to calm it down. But the worst thing happened to you in Mexico City, where he pushed you one day and you went into an office, and in that office you went through the crack between the worlds. He intended only to dispel your attention of the tonal. You were worried sick over some stupid thing, but when he shoved you, your whole tonal shrunk and your entire being went through the crack. He had a hellish time finding you. He told me that for a moment he thought you had gone farther than he could reach. But he brought you back, and he told me that you went through the crack around 10 in the morning. So on that day, 10 in the morning became your new time. My new time for what? For everything. If you remain a man, you will die around that time. If you become a sorcerer, you will leave this world around that time. Allegio went on a different path, a path none of us knew about. We met him just before he left. Allegio was a most marvelous dreamer. He was so good that the Nahual and Gennaro used to take him through the crack, and he had the power to withstand it as if it were nothing. He didn't even pant. The Nahual and Gennaro gave him the final boost with power plants. He had the control and the power to handle that boost, and that's what sent him to wherever he is. The Gennaro told me that Allegio jumped with Benigno. Is that true? Sure. By the time Allegio had jumped, his second attention had already been in the other world. The Nahual said that yours had also been there, but that for you it was a nightmare because you had no control. He said that his power plants had made you lopsided. They had made you cut through your attention of the tonal and had put you directly in the realm of your second attention, but without any mastery over it, over that attention. The Nahual didn't give power plants to Allegio until the very last. Do you think that my second attention has been injured, Gorda? The Nahual never said that. He thought you were dangerously crazy, but that has nothing to do with power plants. He said that both of your attentions are unmanageable, and if you could conquer them, you'd be a great warrior. I wanted her to tell me more on the subject. She put her hand on my writing pad and said that we had a terribly busy day ahead of us, and we needed to store energy in order to withstand it. We had, therefore, to energize ourselves with the sunlight. She said that the circumstances required that we take the sunlight with the left eye. She began to move her head slowly from side to side as she glanced directly into the sun through her half-closed eyes. A moment later, Lydia and Rosa and Josefina joined us. Lydia sat to my right, Josefina sat next to her, while Rosa sat next to Lagorda. All of them were resting their backs against the poles. I was in the middle of the row. It was a clear day. The sun was just above the distant range of the mountains. They started moving their heads in perfect synchronization. I joined them and had the feeling that I, too, had synchronized my motion with theirs. They kept it up for about a minute and then stopped. All of them wore hats and used the brims to protect their faces from the sunlight when they were not bathing their eyes in it. Lagorda had given me my old hat to wear. We sat there for about half an hour. In that time, we repeated the exercise countless times. I intended to make a mark on my pad for each time Lagorda very casually pushed my pad out of reach. Lydia suddenly stood up, mumbled something unintelligible. Lagorda leaned over to me and whispered that the Gennaros were coming up the road. I strained to look, but there was no one in sight. Rosa and Josefina also stood up and went with Lydia inside the house. I told Lagorda that I could not see anyone approaching. She replied that the Gennaros had been visible at one point on the road and added that she had dreaded the moment when all of us would have to get together, but that she was confident that I could handle the situation. She advised me to be extra careful with Josefina and Pablito because they had no control over themselves. She said the most sensible thing for me to do would be to take the Gennaros away after an hour or so. I kept looking at the road. There was no sign of anyone approaching. Are you sure they're coming? I asked. She said that she had not seen them, but that Lydia had. The Gennaros had been visible just for Lydia because she had been gazing at the same time she had been bathing her eyes. I was not sure what Lagorda had meant and asked her to explain. We are gazers, just like yourself. We are all the same. There is no need to deny that you're a gazer. The Nawal told us about your great feats of gazing. My great feats of gazing? What are you talking about, Gorda? She contracted her mouth and appeared to be on the verge of being irritated by my question. She seemed to catch herself. She smiled and gave me a gentle shove. At that moment, she had a sudden flutter in her body. She stared blankly past me and then shook her head vigorously. She said that she had just seen that the Gennaros were not coming after all. It was too early for them. They were going to wait a while before they made their appearance. She smiled as if she were delighted with that delay. It's too early for us to have them here anyway, she said. And they feel the same way about us. Where are they now? I asked. They must be sitting beside the road somewhere, she replied. Benigno had no doubt gazed at the house as they were walking and saw us sitting here, and that's why they've decided to wait. That's perfect. That will give us time. You scare me, Gorda. Time for what? You have to round up your second detention today, just for the four of us. How can I do that? I don't know. You are very mysterious to us. The Nawal has done scores of things to you and with his power plants. But you can't claim them as knowledge. That is what I've been trying to tell you. Only if you have mastery over your second attention can you perform with it. Otherwise, you'll always stay fixed halfway between the two, as you are now. Everything that has happened to you since you arrived has been directed to force that attention to spin. I've been giving you instructions little by little, just as the Nawal told me to do. Since you took another path, you don't know the things that we know, just like we don't know anything about power plants. Solbad knows a bit about more, because the Nawal took her to his homeland. Nesta knows about medicinal plants, but none of us have been taught the way you were. We don't need your knowledge yet, but someday when we're ready, you are the one who will know what to do to give us a boost with power plants. I am the only one who knows where the Nawal's pipe is hidden, awaiting for that day. The Nawal's command is that you have to change your path and go with us. That means that you have to do dreaming with us and stalking with the Gennaros. You can't afford any longer to be where you are, on the awesome side of your second attention. Another jolt of your Nawal coming out of you could kill you. The Nawal told me that human beings are frail creatures composed of many layers of luminosity. When you see them, they seem to have fibers, but those fibers are really layers, like an onion. Jolts of any kind separate those layers and can even cause human beings to die. She stood up and led me back to the kitchen. We sat down facing each other. Lydia and Rosa and Josephina were busy in the yard. I could not see them, but I could hear them talking and laughing. The Nawal said that we die because our layers become separated, Lagorda said. Jolts are always separating them, but they get back together again. Sometimes, though, the jolt is so great that the layers get loose and can't get back together anymore. Have you ever seen the layers, Gorda? I asked. Sure, I saw a man dying in the street. The Nawal told me that you also found the man dying, but you didn't see his death. The Nawal made me see the dying man's layers. They were like peels of an onion. When human beings are healthy, they are like luminous eggs, but if they are injured, they begin to peel like an onion. The Nawal told me that your second attention was so strong sometimes that it pushed all the way out. He and Gennaro had to hold your layers together, otherwise you would have died. That's why he figured that you might have enough energy to get your narwhal out, the narwhal out of you twice. He meant that you could hold your layers together by yourself. You did it more times than that, and now you are finished. You have no more energy to hold your layers together in case of another jolt. The narwhal has entrusted me to take care of everyone. In your case, I have to help you tighten your layers. The narwhal said that death pushes the layers apart. He explained to me that the center of our luminosity, which is the attention of the narwhal, is always pushing out, and that's what loosens the layers. So it's easy for death to come in between them and push them completely apart. Sorcerers have to do their best to keep their own layers closed. That's why the narwhal taught us dreaming. Dreaming tightens the layers. When sorcerers learn dreaming, they tie together their two attentions, and there is no more need for the center to be pushed out. Do you mean that sorcerers do not die? That is right, sorcerers do not die. Do you mean that none of us is going to die? I didn't mean us. We are nothing. We are freaks, neither here nor there. I meant sorcerers. The narwhal and Gennaro are sorcerers. Their two attentions are so tightly together that perhaps they will never die. Did the narwhal say that, Gorda? Yes, he and Gennaro both told me that. Not too long before they left, the narwhal explained to us the power of attention. I never knew what the tonal and the narwhal until then. Lagorda recounted the way Don Juan had instructed them in the crucial tonal narwhal dichotomy. She said that one day the narwhal had all of them gathered together in order to take them for a long hike to a desolate rocky valley in the mountains. He made a large heavy bundle with all kinds of items. He even put Pablito's radio in it, and then gave the bundle to Josefina to carry and put a heavy table on Pablito's shoulders, and they all started hiking. He made all of them take turns carrying the bundle and the table as they hiked nearly 40 miles into that high, desolate place. When they arrived there, the narwhal made Pablito set the table in the very center of the valley. Then he asked Josefina to arrange the contents of the bundle on the table. When the table was filled, he explained to them the difference between the tonal and the narwhal. In the same terms, he had explained it to me in a restaurant in Mexico City, except that in their case, his example was infinitely more graphic. He told them that the tonal was the order that we are aware of in our daily world, and also the personal order that we carry through life on our shoulders, like they had carried that table and bundle. The personal tonal of each of us was like the table in that valley, a tiny island filled with the things that we are familiar with. The narwhal, on the other hand, was the inexplicable source that held that table in place and was like the vastness of that deserted valley. He told them that sorcerers were obligated to watch their tonals from a distance in order to have a better grasp of what was really around them. He made them walk to a ridge from where they could view the whole area. From there, the table was hardly visible. He then made them go back to the table and had them all loom over it in order to show that an average man does not have the grasp that a sorcerer has, because an average man is right on top of his table, holding on to every item on it. He then made each of them, one at a time, casually look at the objects on the table and tested their recall by taking something and hiding it to see if they had been attentive. All of them passed the test with flying colors. He pointed out to them that their ability to remember so easily the items on that table was due to the fact that they all of them had developed their attention of the tonal, or their attention over the table. He then asked them to look casually at everything that was on the ground underneath the table and tested their recall by removing rocks, twigs, or whatever else was there. None of them could remember what they had seen under the table. The narwhal then swept everything off the top of the table and made each of them, one at a time, lie across it on their stomachs and carefully examine the ground underneath. He explained to them that for a saucer, the narwhal was the area just underneath the table. Since it was unthinkable to tackle the immensity of the narwhal, as exemplified by that vast, desolate place, sorcerers took as their domain of activity the area directly below the island of the Tonal, as graphically shown by what was underneath the table. That area was the domain of what he called the second attention, or the attention of the narwhal, or the attention under the table. That attention was reached only after warriors had swept the top off of their tables clean. He said that reaching the second attention made the two attentions into a single unit, and that unit was the totality of oneself. Lagorda said that his demonstrations were so clear to her that her understanding at once why the narwhal had made her clean her own life, sweep her island of the Tonal, as he had called it. She felt that she had indeed been fortunate in having followed every suggestion that he had put to her. She was still a long way from unifying her two attentions, but her diligence had resulted in an impeccable life, which was, as he had assured her, the only way for her to lose her human form. Losing the human form was the essential requirement for the unifying of the two attentions. The attentions under the table is the key to everything sorcerers do, she went on. In order to reach that attention, the narwhal and Gennaro taught us dreaming, and you were taught about power plants. I don't know what they did to you to teach you how to trap your second attention with power plants, but to teach us how to do it in dreaming. The narwhal taught us gazing. He never told us what he was really doing to us. He just taught us how to gaze. We never knew that gazing was the way to trap our second attention. We thought gazing was just for fun. That was not so. Dreamers have to be gazers before they can trap their second attention. The first thing the narwhal did was to put a dry leaf on the ground and made me look at it for hours. Every day he brought a leaf and put it in front of me. At first I thought it was the same leaf that he shaved from day to day. But then I noticed the leaves are different. The narwhal said that when we realize that, we are not looking anymore, but gazing. Then he put stacks of dry leaves in front of me and told me to scramble them with my left hand and feel them as I gazed at them. A dreamer moves the leaves in spirals, gazes at them, and then dreams of the designs that the leaves made. The narwhal said that dreamers can't consider themselves as having mastered leaf gazing when they dream the designs of the leaves first and then find those same designs the next day in their pile of leaves. The narwhal said that gazing at leaves fortifies the second attention. If you gaze at a pile of leaves for hours, he said, as he used to make me do, your thoughts get quiet. Without thoughts, the attention of the Tonal wanes, and suddenly your second attention hooks onto the leaves, and the leaves become something else. The narwhal called that the moment when the second attention hooks onto something, stopping the world. And that is Monk. Cut it out, will ya? Monk. Okay. Without thoughts, the attention of the Tonal wanes, and suddenly a second attention hooks onto the leaves, and the leaves become something else. The narwhal called the moment when the second attention hooks onto something, stopping the world. And that is correct. The world stops. For this reason, There should always be someone around when you gaze. We never know about the quirks of our second attention, since we have never used it. But we have become familiar with it before we could. But we had to become familiar with it before we could venture into gazing alone. The difficulty in gazing is to learn to quiet down the thoughts. The Narwhal said that he preferred to teach us how to do that with a pile of leaves, because we could get all the leaves we needed anytime we wanted to gaze. But anything else would do the same job. Once you can stop the world, you are a gazer. And since the only way of stopping the world is by trying, the Narwhal made all of us gaze at dry leaves for years and years. I think that's the best way to reach your second attention. He combined gazing at dry leaves and looking for our hands and dreaming. It took me about a year to find my hands and 4 years to stop the world. The Narwhal said that once you have trapped your second attention with dry leaves, you do gazing and dreaming to enlarge it, and that's all there is to gazing. You make it sound so simple, Gorda. Everything the Toltecs do is very simple. The Narwhal said that all we needed to do in order to trap our second attention was to try and try. All of us stopped the world by gazing at dry leaves. You and Elysio were different. You yourself did it with power plants, but I don't know what path the Narwhal followed with Elysio. He never wanted to tell me. He told me about you because we have the same task. I mentioned that I had written in my notes that I had had the first complete awareness of having stopped the world only a few days before. She laughed. You stopped the world before any of us, she said. But what do you think you did when you took all those power plants? You've never done it by gazing like we did, that's all. Was the pile of dry leaves the only thing the Narwhal made you gaze at? Once dreamers know how to stop the world, they can gaze at other things. And finally, when the dreamers lose their form altogether, they can gaze at anything to do that. I can go into anything. He made us follow a certain order in gazing, though. First, we gazed at small plants. The Narwhal warned us that small plants are very dangerous. Their power is concentrated. They have very intense light, and they feel when dreamers are gazing at them. They immediately move their light and shoot it at the gazer. Dreamers have to choose one kind of plant to gaze at. Next, we gazed at trees. Dreamers also have a particular kind of tree to gaze at. In this respect, you and I are the same. Both of us are eucalyptus gazers. By the look on her face, she must have guessed my next question. The Narwhal said that with his smoke, you could very easily get your second attention to work, she went on. You focus your attention a lot of times on the Narwhal's predilection, the crows. He said that once your second attention focused so perfectly on the crow that it flew away like a crow flies to the only eucalyptus tree that was around. For years I had dwelt upon that experience. I could not regard it in any other way except as an inconceivably complex hypnotic state brought about by my psychotropic mushrooms contained in Don Juan's smoking mixture in conjunction with his expertise as a manipulator of behavior. He suggested a perceptual catharsis in me, that of turning into a crow and perceiving the world as a crow. The result was that I perceived the world in a manner that could not have possibly been part of my inventory of past experiences. Lagorda's explanation somehow had simplified everything. She said that the Narwhal next made them gaze at moving, living creatures. He told them that small insects were by far the best subject. Their mobility made them innocuous to the gazer, the opposite of plants, which drew their light directly from the earth. The next step was to gaze at rocks. She said that rocks were very old and powerful and had a specific light which was rather greenish in contrast to the white light of plants and the yellowish light of mobile living beings. Rocks do not open up easily to gazers, but it was worthwhile for gazers to persist because rocks had special secrets concealed in their core, secrets that would aid sorcerers in dreaming. What are the things that rocks reveal to you? I asked. When I gaze into the very core of a rock, she said, I always catch a whiff of a special scent proper to that rock. When I roam around in my dreaming, I know where I am because I am guided by those scents. She said that the time of day was a very important factor in tree and rock gazing. In the early morning, trees and rocks were stiff and their light was faint. Around noon, when they were at their best, the gazing at that time was done for borrowing their light and power. In the late afternoon and the early evening, trees and rocks were quiet and sad, especially trees. The Gorda said that at that hour, trees give the feeling that they were gazing back at the gazer. The second series in order of gazing was to gaze at cyclical phenomena, rain, fog. She said that gazers can focus their second attention on the rain itself and move with it, or focus it on the background and use the rain as a magnifying glass of sorts to reveal the hidden features. Places of power or places to be avoided are found by gazing through rain. Places of power are yellowish and places to be avoided are intensely green. Lagorda said that the fog was unquestionably the most mysterious thing on earth for a gazer, and that it could be used in the same two ways that rain was used. But it did not easily yield to women, and even after she had lost her human form, it remained unobtainable to her. She said that the narwhal once had made her see a green mist at the head of a fog bank and told her that was the second attention of a fog gazer who lived in the mountains where she and the narwhal were, and that he was moving with the fog. She added that fog was used to uncover the ghosts of things that were no longer there, and that the true fear of fog gazers was to let their second attention go into whatever their gazing was revealing to them. I told her that once while I was with Don Juan, I had seen a bridge formed out of a fog bank. I was aghast at the clarity and precise detail of that bridge. To me, it was more than real. The scene was so intense and vivid that I had been incapable of forgetting it. Don Juan's comment had been that I would have to cross that bridge someday. I know about it, she said. The narwhal told me that someday, when you have mastery over your second attention, you will cross that bridge with the attention, in the same way you flew with, like a crow, with that attention. He said that if you become a sorcerer, a bridge will form for you out of the fog, and you will cross it and disappear from this world forever, just like he himself has done. Did he disappear like that over a bridge? No, not over a bridge, but you witness how he and Gennaro stepped into the crack between the worlds in front of your very eyes. Nesta said that only Gennaro waved his hand to say goodbye the last time you saw them. The narwhal did not wave because he was opening the crack. The narwhal told me that when the second attention has to be called upon to assemble itself, all that is needed is the motion of opening that door. That's the secret of the Toltec dreamers once they are formless. I wanted to ask her about Don Juan and Don Gennaro stepping through that crack. She made me stop with a light touch of her hand on my stomach. She said that another series was distance and cloud gazing. In both, the effort of the gazer was to let their second attention go to the place where they were gazing at. Thus, they covered great distances or rode on clouds, in the case of cloud gazing. The Nawal never permitted them to gaze at thunderheads. He told them that they had to be formless before they could attempt that feat, and that they could not ride on a thunderhead, but on a thunderbolt itself. Lagorda laughed and asked me to guess who would be daring and crazy enough to actually try to gaze at thunderheads. I could think of no one else but Josefina. Lagorda said that Josefina tried to gaze at thunderheads one time, she could when the Nawal was away, until one day a thunderbolt nearly killed her. Janeiro was a thunderbolt sorcerer, she went on. His last two appearances, Benigno and Nestor, were singled out for him by his friend, the Thunder. He said that he was looking for plants in a very remote area where the Indians are very private and don't like visitors of any kind. They had given Janeiro permission to be on their land, and since he spoke their language, the Janeiros were picking some plants when it began to rain. There were some houses around, but the people were unfriendly and didn't want to bother them, and he didn't want to bother them. He was about to crawl into a hole when he saw a young man coming down the road riding a bicycle heavily laden with goods. It was Benigno, the man from the town who dealt with those Indians. His bicycle got stuck in the mud, was right there, a thunderbolt struck him. Janeiro thought he had been killed. People in the houses had seen what happened and came out. Benigno was more scared than hurt, but his bicycle and all his merchandise was ruined. Janeiro stayed with him for a week and cured him. Almost the same time that happened to Nesta, he used to buy medicinal plants from Janeiro. And one day he followed him into the mountains to see where he picked his plants so he wouldn't have to pay him anymore. Janeiro went very far into the mountains on purpose. He intended to make Nesta get lost. It wasn't raining, but there were thunderbolts. And suddenly a thunderbolt struck the ground and ran over the dry ground like a snake. It ran between Nestor's legs and hit a rock 10 yards away. Janeiro said that the bolt had charred the inside of Nestor's legs. His testicles were swollen and he got very ill. Janeiro had to cure him for a week right in those mountains. By the time Benigno and Nestor were cured, they were also hooked. Men have to be hooked. Women don't need that. Women go freely into anything. That's their power, and at the same time, their drawback. Men have to be led, and women have to be contained. She giggled and said that no doubt she had a lot of maleness in her, for she needed to be led, and that I must have a lot of femaleness in me, for I needed to be contained. The last series was fire, smoke and shadow gazing. She said that for a gazer, fire is not bright but black, and so is smoke. Shadows, on the other hand, are brilliant and have color and movement in them. There were two more things that were kept separate, star and water gazing. Stargazing was done by sorcerers who have lost their human form. She said that she had fared very well at stargazing, but could not handle gazing at water, especially running water, which was used by formless sorcerers to gather their second attention and transport it any place they needed to go. All of us are terrified of water, she went on. A river gathers the second attention and takes it away, and there is no way of stopping. The Nawal told me about your feats of water gazing, but you also told me that one time you nearly disintegrated in the water of a shallow river and that you can't even take a bath now. Don Juan had made me stare at the water of an irrigation ditch behind his house various times while he had me under the influence of his smoking mixture. I had experienced inconceivable sensations. Once I saw myself all green as if I were covered with algae. After that, he recommended that I avoid water. Has my second attention been injured by water? I asked. It has, she replied. You are a very indulging man. The Nawal warned you to be cautious, but you went beyond your limits with running water. The Nawal said that you could have used the water like no one else, but it wasn't your fate to be moderate. She pulled her bench closer to me. That's all there is to gazing, she said. But there are other things I must tell you before we leave. What things, Gorda? First of all, before I say anything, you must round up your second attention for the little sisters and me. I don't think I can do that. She stood up and went into the house. She came back a moment later with a small, thick, round cushion made out of the same natural fibers used in making nets. Without saying a word, she led me again to the front porch. She said that she had made that cushion herself for her comfort when she was learning to gaze, because the position of the body was of great importance when one is learning to gaze. One had to sit on the ground on a soft mat of leaves or on a cushion made out of natural fibers. The back had to be propped up against a tree or a stump or a flat rock. The body had to be thoroughly relaxed. The eyes were never fixed on the object in order to avoid tiring them. The gaze consisted in scanning very slowly the object gazed at, going counterclockwise but without moving the head. She added that the Nawal had made them plant those thick poles so they could use them to prop themselves. She had me sit on a cushion and prop my back against the pole. She told me that she was going to guide me in gazing at a power spot the Nawal had in the round hills across the valley. She hoped that by gazing at it, I could get the necessary energy to round up my second attention. She sat down very close to me, to my left, and began giving me instructions. Almost in a whisper, she told me to keep my eyelids half closed and stare at the place where two enormous round hills converged. She said that there was a narrow, steep water canyon there. She said that that particular gazing consisted of four separate actions. The first one was to use the brim of my hat as a visor to shade off the excessive glare from the sun and allow only a minimal amount of light to come to my eyes. Then, to half close my eyelids, the third step was to sustain the opening of my eyelids in order to maintain a uniform flow of light. The fourth step was to distinguish the water canyon in the background through the mesh of the light fibers on my eyelashes. I could not follow her instructions at first. The sun was high over the horizon, and I had to tilt my head back. I tipped my head until I had blocked most of the glare with the brim. That seemed to be all there was needed. As soon as I half closed my eyes, a bit of light appeared as if it were coming from the tip of my hat, literally exploded on my eyelashes, which were acting as a filter that created a web of light. I kept my eyelids half closed and played with the web of light for a moment until I could distinguish the dark vertical outline of the water canyon in the background. Lagorda told me then to gaze at the middle part of the canyon until I could spot a very dark brown blotch. She said that it was a hole in the canyon, which was not there for the eye that looks, but only for the eye that sees. She warned me that I had to exercise my control as soon as I had isolated that blotch, so that it would not pull me toward it. Rather, I was supposed to zoom in on it and gaze into it. She suggested that the moment I found the hole, I should press my shoulders on hers to let her know. She slid sideways until she was leaning on me. I struggled for a moment, the four actions coordinated and steady. And suddenly a dark spot formed in the middle of the canyon. I noticed immediately that I was not seeing it in the way I usually saw. The dark spot was rather an impression, a visual distortion of sport. A visual distortion of sorts. The moment my control waned, it disappeared. I was in my field of perception only if I kept the four actions under control. I remembered then that Don Juan had engaged me countless times in a similar activity. He used to hang a small piece of cloth from a low branch of a bush, which was strategically located to be in line with specific geological formations in the mountains in the background, such as water canyons or slopes. By making me sit 50 feet away from that piece of cloth and having me stare until the low branches of the bush where the cloth hung, he used to create a special perceptual effect for me. The piece of cloth, which was always a shade darker than the geological formation I was staring at, soon seemed to be at first a feature of that formation. The idea was to let my perception play without analyzing it. I failed every time because I was thoroughly incapable of suspending judgment, and my mind always entered into the rational speculation that the rational speculation about the mechanics of my phantom perception. This time I had no need whatsoever for speculations. Lagorda was not an imposing figure that I had unconsciously needed to fight, as Don Juan had obviously been for me. The dark blotch in my field of perception became almost black. I leaned on Lagorda's shoulder and let her know. She whispered in my ear that I should struggle to keep my eyelids in the position they were in and breathe calmly from my abdomen. I should not let the blotch pull me, but gradually go into it. The thing to avoid was letting the hole grow and suddenly engulf me. In the event that that happened, I had to open my eyes immediately. I began to breathe as she prescribed, and thus I could keep my eyelids fixed indefinitely on the appropriate aperture. I remained in that position for quite some time. Then I noticed that I had begun to breathe normally, and that it had not been disturbed, that it had not disturbed my perception of the dark blotch. But suddenly the dark blotch began to move, to pulsate, and before I could breathe calmly again, the blackness moved forward and enveloped me. I became frantic and opened my eyes. Lagorda said I was doing distance gazing, and that for that is what was necessary to breathe the way she had recommended. She urged me to start all over again. She said that the Nawal used to make them sit for entire days, rounding up their second attention by gazing at that spot. He cautioned them repeatedly about the danger of being engulfed by the jolt the body suffered. It took me about an hour of gazing to do what she had delineated. To zoom in on the brown spot and gaze into it meant that the brown patch in my field of perception lightened up quite suddenly. As it became clearer, I realized that something in me was performing an impossible act. I felt that I was actually advancing toward that spot. Thus, the impression I was having that it was clearing up. Then I was so near to it that I could distinguish features in it, like rocks, vegetation. I came even closer and could look at particular formation in one rock. It looked like a roughly carved chair. I liked it very much compared to the rest of the rocks, which seemed pale and uninteresting. I didn't know how long I gazed at it. I could focus on every detail of it. I felt I could lose myself forever in its detail because there was no end to it. But something dispelled my view. Another strange image was superimposed on the rock, and then another one, and another yet. I became annoyed with the interference, At that instant, I became annoyed. I also realized that LaGuardia was moving my head from side to side behind me. In a matter of seconds, the concentration of my gazing had thoroughly dissipated. LaGuardia laughed and said that she understood why I had caused the narwhal such intense concern. She had seen for herself that I had indulged beyond my limits. She said she sat against the pole next to me and said that she and the little sisters were going to gaze into the narwhal's power place. She then made a piercing bird call. A moment later, the little sisters came out of the house and sat down to gaze with her. End of part 1 of chapter 6.